Good day, everyone, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange conference call. Today's call is being recorded. And now for introductions, I'd like to turn the call over to Ms. Christy Snyder. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Tom, and welcome everyone to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ Distributed Queuing Overview and Common Problems on ZOS. During the presentation, all lines will be muted. After the presentation, the lines will open for a question and answer session. Today's presenters are Kenneth Langhorne and Laurinette Wheeler. Kenneth Langhorne is a software engineer with WebSphere MQ. Kenneth has been on the WebSphere MQ Level 2 support team from the inception of the product in 1993 after supporting CICS for several years. His primary support is for WebSphere MQ on iSeries and the distributed platforms, but has also supported WebSphere MQ on ZOS and VSC. Kenneth has 20 years with the IBM Corporation. Laurinette Wheeler is a software engineer with the WebSphere MQ on ZOS and VSC Level 2 support team. She has 27 years with the IBM Corporation. Laurinette served in ZOS Communication Server customer support for 10 years before joining the WebSphere MQ support team in September 2003. In this capacity, she is responsible for focusing on solving customer situations with WebSphere MQ on ZOS and VSC. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Kenneth. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, everyone, or afternoon to some. Page 2 is our introduction. The purpose of this presentation is to review the basic WebSphere MQ series distributed queuing information and some of the common distributed queuing problems on ZOS. Next page. We're going to discuss the messaging and queuing as an overview, and we will also go over distributed queuing. Then we will touch base on the common problems we see on ZOS, and then we will direct you to some pertinent websites. Next page. Participants should be familiar with one or more of these books listed. Next page. The challenge we had back in 92-93 was that many of our customers had their own enterprise where their application programmers were coding to different platforms using different transport layers, APPN, OSI, TCP, and they had customers and suppliers that had their own environments. Now, over time, applications became more and more tied back to the way they had been written previously, and it led to limitations on design choices, and they noticed that they had high maintenance costs and high implementation costs. And eventually, they would sometimes run into inflexible solutions because of being tied to something they coded years ago. Next page. Around 1992, IBM came up with a network blueprint. And in the middle of the fifth layer, you can see messaging and queuing as one of the possible multi-vendor applications or support for multiple vendor applications. Message queuing had been around well before 1992, but what we did was create an API that was simple and ran on multiple platforms. Next page. And the advantages of WebSphere MQ series commercial messaging is the time independence, the assured delivery, the cross-platform compatibility, and the fact that you were now able to shield your developers from some of the complexities of coding to the various communication protocols. And that allows them to concentrate on their business applications as opposed to learning SNA or TCP/IP. Next page. This gives you one of the advantages of the time independence. In a typical application, you have the logical connection where program A puts data, program B gets the data, and they're connected, and you expect them to be connected. But when you take advantage of messaging and queuing, the two programs need not necessarily be running at the same time. So you can either have A loading up the queue while B is busy doing something else, or B could be down while A continues to load the queue, and vice versa. When A is done, B can come and get the data when he chooses to come and get it. And the other advantage is if both of them go down, message queuing has the ability to store forward to maintain those messages until it's an appropriate time for you to get next page. So the basic construct is a message. And a message basically has two fields. The user data, which is exchanged between the programs, and then there's some header data that the queue manager will use and may have to manipulate. You will normally see a message descriptor in there. You may see other things. Next page. And this is just a high-level view of how the API, the simple API we coded, which was about 13 verbs, a program will use those to talk to the queue manager and access the queue. They may even access something like our process definitions or some of the other queue manager objects like a log or a channel initiator. Next page. Now, even though there are only 13 calls in this API, the four at the top, the MQCon, the MQOpen, the MQPut, and MQGet, are our big hitters. They are what most people use. Now, all 13 of these between them have over 250 options, but you can normally let the call default, use the default options in MQ series, and get what you want to get from that. Next page. Now, I alluded to this queue manager earlier. You have to have the queue manager basically is the system program that provides the queuing service to your applications. It provides the application programming interface, which we call the MQI, that allows you to put and get messages from a queue. Now, that is controlled by the kernel component. There are two other components that we emphasize, which is the local queue manager component, and that deals with your operating system. That will deal with the file system, the operating system primitives, the timers, and so forth. And then the third major component is the message moving component, and that is the bread and butter of distributed queuing. This is the one that has an MQ series application we call the message channel agent. Next page. Now, the queue manager has to have somewhere to put these messages, and we call it a queue. It's managed by the queue manager, and it's the destination where the messages are either put or gotten from. Next page. And with MQ series, there are two queues, basically. You have your local queues. There are variations of the local queue and the remote queue. The local queues that people deal with distributed queuing is the transmit queue. There's another queue we call the dead letter or undelivered message queue that comes into play sometimes when you cannot put a message on the proper destination queue. There's a way of indirection we call alias queue, like, for instance, my name's Kenneth, and alias to Kenneth may be Kenny. Another way of addressing the queue. And when we deal with our trigger monitors, we have this thing we call the initiation queue. Now, local queues, you can retrieve messages from a local queue, but in addition to that, you can also put messages to a local queue. And a remote queue also has the capability for you to put a message to. But remember, you can only retrieve the messages from the local queue. Now, what this does is, since the remote queue is really a definition of a queue that really resides on another queue manager, it allows the application to put to that queue without actually specifying that particular queue. So you don't have to name it the queue, the remote queue manager name, or the transmit queue by using this remote queue. And what this does is give you location independence. Next forward. And basically that location independence makes this, when you're using distributed queuing, this Q2 is on system 2. But you could have just as easily had it running on system 1. But because we use remote queue definitions, we have the capability of moving it over to another system. It could be on the same box or on a different box. And the application doesn't even care. Next four. Okay. Now, with distributed queuing, the major components are the message channels, the message channel agent, the transmission queues, channel initiators and listeners, and channel exit programs. Next four. Can we skip that one? Now, what is a channel? There are basically two channels that we deal with in MQ series. The message channel is a unidirectional channel. This is the main channel we use. It is tied up into pairs. It can be called a sender, a receiver, a server, a requester, a cluster sender, or a cluster receiver. And you have about five combinations you can set up between those. And that's what most people use. In addition to this, we, after we came out with this client or MQI channel. Now that has two channels. One's called the server connection and the other one's the client connection. Next poll. Now I want to go with the message channel or the unidirectional channel and lay that out. What sometimes is hard to get around is in the middle of this picture where you see the message flow, there's a message, the MCA on Queue Manager 1. That's the outbound or sender or sometimes server channel. And on the other side in Queue Manager 2, you have the MCA or message channel agent that would be the inbound, which would normally be the receiver or requester channel. Now, in between them, where you see message flow in the odd color, that represents the communication link. And that could be TCP/IP, that could be SNA, I think SPX, and there's another one that Windows supports. NetBIOS, I believe it is. But effectively, that's your channel when you combine these. Next four. Now for client or MQI channels, as we said earlier, you have the server connection and the client connection. The client connection would be on the left side, and the server connection would be on the right side on the server machine. Now the big difference is this communication link is bidirectional. And what happens is the client sends a request up to the server, but he gives that request to your transport layer, who gives it to the server. He executes the MQAPI request and comes back and gives the response back to the communication link, and it goes back to the client. Now, the difference is, in those two trips, the transport layer is in control, which would be TCP/IP or SNA, as opposed to MQ series, controlling this piece of the link. And so we don't have as much control in this particular configuration as the other one. Next page. This trigger channel start is a flow from the intercommunications guide, and I mainly wanted to show how it's triggered like a regular triggered application. Somebody puts a message to the transmit queue. The transmit queue generates a trigger message which goes to the initiation queue. Our channel listener is the trigger monitor in this case. He parses out the message from the initiation queue, and it tells him to start the channel that will go and retrieve the message from the transmission queue and send it over to the partner on the other side. Next four. This just combines the channel initiator with the channel listener in a standard configuration. Now, one of the things we need to remember is the implementation of the channel initiator is platform specific. Now, in ZOS's case, both the sender and the receiver run inside the channel initiator. So one of the things he will do is the short retry and long retry. He will take care of that. On some of your other platforms, like 400 Unix or Windows, you need to have the channel initiator running if you want the short retry to kick in. If you have a situation, and that normally would kick in when there's some type of problem from the transport layer that we think is going to be short-lived, then we will retry the connection based on your short retry and long retry parameters. Okay. Next. Now, channel exits, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with them, but I mainly wanted you to get the flow of if you're using the exits, after you initialize a channel, you would go to the security exit. And then we can go to the message exit and the send exit on down the flow. Now, at the bottom of this, you see a message retry. Now, that's an exit that up until version 6, ZOS did not participate with. And that's one that comes into play on the receiving side, which would be normally the requester or the receiver channel. If you have trouble delivering a message to an application queue, you can set up the message retry parameters to say how many times you want to retry and how frequently before you go back and then try to deliver it to the dead letter queue. And if you don't have a dead letter queue, we'll roll it back to the transmission queue on the other side. Next page. This channel status flow is from the intercommunications guide in Figure 29, and I've used this for years. What I like about it is it shows you the channel status. You basically have current or inactive are your channel status. Now, if it's current, you can be in stop, starting, or retrying without, and you're not really doing anything. But if you're in active status, you could be doing one of these subsets below. You could be initializing, binding, requesting, running, stopping, or even in pause. Now, in that pause, I've seen that when someone's using that message retry exit. That's when I normally see, well, that's the only time I've seen the pause status personally. But the nice part about this flow is it also gives you an idea of which exits you can be going through if you're in that state. Next. In this channel control chart, the nice part about this basically shows you how we go about starting a channel. You can start it from the commands. You can trigger the start. And they got the remote initiation. That would be if you're using the requester channel to kick off the start of this channel. And the channel initiator itself would be how most people would start a channel. Now, the other interesting thing, if you notice in the center of this, you'll see the four at the bottom from initializing through stopping and across from pause to requesting. They're shaded a little darker than the other ones. When you're doing any of these steps, you're using resources of the queue manager. Next form. Now, some people may wonder why you have queue name resolution here. This is really the bread and butter of distributed queuing. If you can understand the queue name resolution, if you're having problems with identifying where a message is or where it should be going, you can probably figure it out on your own. Now, what it does for you is your applications don't have to make routing decisions. The applications don't have to know the network structure. Now, they say the network links are created by system administrators. Now, that varies between the MQ series person or somebody in the network group. And the network structure is controlled by network planners. Again, that varies between the MQ series and the network group. But the thing that should be remembered from this foil is the MQ series administrator and the network people really have, in early days I see stuff like we remove network complexity, but what it does is it takes network complexity from the application programmer and hands it to the MQ series administrator and your network team. And if there are problems, then the two of those need to work closely together. Next four. And this is more detail about queue name resolution. And as it states, it is vital to distributed queuing. If we didn't have this, we would have a nightmare trying to keep up with distributed queuing. Next four. And this is just a big picture of queue name resolution. If machine A is doing a put call, they do a queue name resolution process to figure out which transmit queue to go to. And then the sending MCA gets the message, goes out to the network, and gives it to the receiving MCA. The receiving MCA looks at, pulls the header off of it and says, oh, it goes to this target queue, and gives it to the target queue. And once that batch is completed, he sends back a confirmation to the sending side, which allows the sending side to send any more data that's on that transmission queue. And so that's basic queue name resolution at a high level. Now, the power of this resolution is queue manager. You can also use our queue name resolution to affect queue manager aliasing. Next slide, please. In queue manager aliasing, gives us four things. It allows us to remap the queue manager name when sending messages. It allows us to specify the transmission queue when sending messages. It will let us determine the destination when receiving messages. And it also lets queue managers act as gateways into clusters. Next four. And I just took this picture to show you how you could, on queue manager one with the upper transmission queue, be trying to send data to queue manager three with the application queue. Now, since you don't have a direct queue to queue manager three, you could define a remote queue with queue manager three, and it would have a remote name of blank, but the remote queue manager name would be QM3, and the transmit queue would be QM2. That would allow anything that's destined for some queue at queue manager three to go through queue manager two, and since it wouldn't belong to him, he would pass it on if there was a default or a transmit queue that went to queue manager three to them. And that's the power of queue manager aliases. Next four. Now, earlier I mentioned that there are times where the dead letter queue comes into play. Now, when we're dealing with channels, we don't really see a lot of it going to the dead letter queue on the sending side these days. In the early days when we had problems with data conversion, we would sometimes see a message go here, but I don't really see it. That I haven't seen it in a while. But a lot of times when you're sending data over, you can be sending data to all three queues on Queue Manager 2. And if by chance the bottom one fills up, that message retry could come into play if you're not ZOS53. And after it exhausts those, if you can't deliver it to the application queue, it would put it to this dead letter queue. If eventually it fills up the dead letter queue under Queue Manager 2, it would roll the batch back to the transmission queue on Queue Manager 1 and stop the channel. And you'd have messages in our logs to tell you that you need to take action. Next four. And what I just discussed goes back to the assured delivery. Because what would have happened was you sent however many messages were in the batch, then the sending side would send this confirmed flow. But in this particular diagram, what they're saying is, if before queue manager 2 sends back the confirmation, then he got the confirmed flow, if the network drops, then we will store some information in the channel sync queue about the channel being in doubt. And the next, when the network comes up and we try to reestablish the connection? There is some logic in MQ series that should resolve this if it can. If it cannot resolve it on its own, then you will get CSQX 526, I think it is, or an AMQ 9526, message sequence number mismatch or something like that. And but you'd have to run the display channel status save current logical unit of work, and based on that, you would resolve the channel to either commit or back out. Next slide. Now, in the early days, SNA was the primary majority of our channels were SNA, but as time went on, TCP gained in popularity. And what we've found over time is that there are different situations where we lose the connection between the channels because of some flow that we do or don't get from TCP IP. And one of the mechanisms we have is this heartbeat flow. If the channel has a disconnect interval that says stay up for 5 hours or stay up forever, and there are no messages on the transmit queue, then based on your heartbeat interval, when that occurs, we will send a heartbeat flow across to test the connection. And the good part is if it ends up that there's a problem on the network, it allows us to stop the channel gracefully so that hopefully when we start it back up, whatever the problem was will have been resolved. Next call. Another tool in this environment is the adopt MCA. Again, this one, I believe, came out because overnight or over the weekends, we would sometimes find where the network would be changed or somebody would do something to the network, and a channel that had a long disconnect interval may have gone away on the sending side, but the receiving channel is sitting out there waiting for something to come. And when the sending channel is started back up, it will not connect because there's an orphaned receiver channel. Now, if you make use of this adopt MCA, you can tell it to blow away the old receiver channel and start a new one for you. Next one. Now, the granddaddy of the help force is this TCPIP keep alive. This is actually a TCPIP parameter. And the biggest challenge with it is that it defaults usually to 2 hours. So on most platforms, customers have to look at what other applications are using TCPIP to decide what is a reasonable value to set it to. And on MQ series for ZOS, the nice part was with the KAINT, you set it specifically for a channel as opposed to having to set it for everybody. Next four. And this is a list of the primary parameters and channels that usually come into play when we're trying to diagnose a problem with MQ series channels. You've heard some of them, the heartbeat interval. I think I mentioned the disconnect interval. Other things like the batch interval and the batch size come into play. And that's the first section. Now, if you go a little bit lower halfway through this, you see QM any channel status. Those are the adopt MCA, and you need to say keep alive to let us participate with TCPIP keep alive. They would go in the QM any file for the distributed side. Now, the middle of the page, the alt queue manager, are the equivalent parameters for ZOS. And at the bottom of the page, sometimes the sender channel gets orphaned. And we can sometimes, this making use of this receiver timeout can help us in those situations. Next slide. Now, over the years, these are some of the more common commands that we end up using when we're diagnosing channel concerns. The ping channel, I believe, is underused. This is an MQ ping, not the TCP ping. This is the MQ series ping channel. And the nice part about it is when you're testing a channel for the first time, you can use it. But if you're having trouble with data going across your network and you're trying to figure out what your size limit is, you can use this data length field to try different sizes and see what you get back. And these other ones are standard commands that if you're familiar with the MQSC, run MQSC on distributed and CSQ util for us on DOS. Next slide. Now, I just put this one in to show the big picture of we have user exits, the message channel agent on the sending side, the message channel agent on the other side, the channel initiator listener. This is just trying to show you how it all fits together. And it's my hope that everyone has a more in-depth understanding of how MQ series came into being and a high level of how distributed queuing works. At this time, I would like to turn this over to Laurinette.
Thank you, Kenny.
You're welcome.
Okay, now we're going to talk about some common problems that we experience for WebSphere MQ Distributed, and we're going to talk about problems that we see on the ZOS box. I'm sorry, Christy, next for you. Okay, go ahead to the next for you. Okay, so the standard distributed queuing messages on ZOS start with CSQX, and on a distributed box, it starts with AMQ9. And most of them have a one-to-one correlation. For instance, if you see CSQX208 on the ZOS box, you'll see an AMQ9208 on the distributed box. Next for you. So this is one of the most common problems that we see reported by customers. Multiple CSQX208 easy error messages in the channel initiator job log. And when you see this error message, it means that the sender or the receiver channel has issued a TCP/IP read, and we're waiting for data from the remote partner, but instead of receiving data, the read call fails with a -1 and a TCP/IP error number. And the return code in that message represents the error number that TCP/IP has returned. Next for you. But some of the common return codes, one of the most common return codes from TCP/IP is the 461. And the 461 means that the connection has been reset by the peer. In the CSQX208 easy error message, the connection number is not necessarily the IP address that the reset came from, but it's the IP address that we are connected with when the reset appeared. Next for you. So some of the reasons for TCP/IP resets, and I put these here just to let you know that TCP resets are not related to the application, not related to MQ. MQ is just an application running on top of TCP/IP. TCP/IP will send a reset just if there's something invalid about the particular connection. So some of the reasons, and I won't go over all of them, and all of these are not really related to the read call, but some of the reasons are if an application issues a connect for a port or IP address and there's no listener listening on that port, then under the covers, TCP will reset that, but the application will receive an econ refuse. Another reason that TCP will send a reset is if a connection is closed and data arrives on that connection after it has been closed, TCP will send a reset just to let the remote partner know that the data was not delivered. We've seen firewalls reset, send resets because the IP or port number was not in the firewall rule or policy database. And we've also seen resets from bad hardware, such as cards, switches, routers. Next page. Okay, so another common error that we see with the CSQX208 Easy is the return code 480. And when you see the return code 480, it still means that we have issued a TCP/IP read, but we have canceled the TCP/IP read. So a 480 means that the asynchronous I/O call, which is the read call, has been canceled. And we'll cancel the read call for really one reason, and that is to force the channel down. But we'll force the channel down for a couple of reasons, and that's if a command is issued to stop the channel with mode force, or if the channel is being adopted, and Of course, like Kenny said, when the channel has been adopted, the sender has lost its connection with the receiver, and we are now trying to reestablish that connection with the receiver. So under the covers, the MCA will force the channel down so that a new connection can be established. Next for you. And I wanted to point out on this screen just an example of what the message looks like. You'll see the return code 480. You'll see that the channel ends abnormally, and then you'll see immediately after that the channel is being adopted, and then that the channel is restarted. And another indication that the channel is being adopted or the channel is being forced down is if you see a return code 0101 with the CSQX208EC error message. And what's happening here is when the asynchronous I.O. call is canceled, it's up to OMBF to post our ECB to say that the call has been canceled. And if we check that the high-order bits for the ECB and the high-order bits have not been turned on, then we'll post the ECB and we'll return a 0101 return code. Okay, next for you. Okay, this is one, well, we don't see this message often, but I put it here just to let you know what other type of errors that you can see in the channel-initiated job log. Here, when an application or channel connects to us, we are issued a get peer name just to see who's connecting to us. And in this instance, the get peer name failed with a return code 464. So what happened, there was a workload manager router that was going out and touching the listener just to see if the port was there. And by the time we issued our get peer name, the router closed the socket connection, and our get peer name failed with a 464 saying that the socket was not connected. So the point here is that MQ will accept connection requests from other sources. But if we get as far as reading data and the data is not in our protocol, then we'll close the channel and send a message saying that we have received invalid data. Next for you. Okay, so the CSQX053EC, you'll see these two messages in the channel initiator job log. If something bad has happened and we need to write to our CSQ snap data set, and the CSQ snap data set is just another DD that we've placed in the channel initiator job log so that if we have errors, we can write more details. So you'll see the CSQX053EC error, and then you'll see the CSQX207EC stating that we have received invalid data, and it'll identify what IP address we've received that invalid data from. In some instances, we've seen that, doing testing, then we're just trying to test to see if the listener is up, so they'll telnet into the listener, and once they telnet into the listener, and telnet sends its data, we don't understand the telnet protocol, so we'll close the connection and send a message saying that we've received invalid data. Again, if we have routers out, just touching the listener to see if they're there, and we get as far as reading the data and we don't understand the data, then we'll close the connection and issue the CSQX207EC message stating that we've received invalid data. Next for you. Okay, this is an indication of a network problem. You can see that the sender is trying to establish a connection with the listener on the receiver side, and you'll see a message that comes back and says that the connect has timed out, and you see a return code 467. And in this instance, it means that we've tried to connect usually for about 3 minutes is the TCP/IP hard-coded connect time. You'll try for about 3 minutes to try to connect, and we'll send our send packet, and if we never receive the acknowledgement packet, then the connection will time out. And then you will see us issue a CSQX202EC message saying that the listener is unavailable, and we get a return code 468 indicating that the network is unavailable. Again, this is another indication of a network problem. Okay, next slide. We also get reports of CSQX209EC error. And the thing here to remember is we, again, have issued a TCP/IP read, but instead of the read coming back with data, the read returns with a return code 0. And in TCP protocol, return code 0 on a read means that the remote partner has closed its side of the connection. So you have to go and examine what's happening on the remote partner side to determine, you know, why the connection is closed. I've seen instances where the heartbeat interval expired and the receiver closed the connection. I've seen instances where we receive invalid data and we close the connection. And also, again, instances where you have applications such as port scanners that scanning the listener just to see if it's there. And by the time we issue the read, the scanner will close the connection, and we get a return code 0. So bottom line here is, when you see a CSQ-X209 easy, it's usually not a problem on the ZOS box, but it's a problem with maybe the remote partner or whoever we're in communication with. Next slide. Okay, here is the sample problem that was reported to us. And the IP addresses and the channel names have been changed to protect the innocent. Now, we don't see the CSQX206 easy error often. Here, in this instance, the sender was in a TCPIP send call, and the connection failed. And the connection failed with the return code HCHARLIE, saying that the pipe has been broken, or in other words, the connection has been severed. So the channel ends abnormally, but right away the sender tries to reestablish the connection with the receiver on the remote side. Now you see a little bit later that the receiver on the ZOS had to be adopted because the sender on the Sun Solaris side lost its connection to our receiver. So here you'll see the CSQX 208 easy, the return code 480. You see that the channel ended abnormally because we're forcing the channel down. The channel's been adopted. We're allowing the connection to be established again, and the channel is started again. Okay? Next for you. Okay, so this was not a simple problem, and we had to get a lot of documentation. It looks simple now that I'm going to explain it, but it's a little difficult when we had to go through the process. So we had to get a packet trace, we had to get internal traces, dumps, and job logs to figure out the problem. So this is a C-trace example. This is an example of the command, a C-trace command, and the option session allows the sessions to be summarized. So you see how many packets were summarized. You'll see the local IP address, the remote IP address. You'll see the local and remote ports. The local port indicates that this is a sender channel because the remote port is our default 1414 or our default sender. Default receiver. Now, the information also provides the timestamp when the connection started, the timestamp when the connection dropped, and the final state of the connection once the packet trace was taken. Next for you. Okay, so this is a sample summary of the a packet trace that we were able to capture to figure out this problem. So the TCP header are the flags that we see, like a send, an act push, a send, or a reset. The I/O header means input or output. So O means that we're going out from the host. The I means we're coming into the host. The sequence number represents the number of the first byte that's being sent. The act number represents the next byte that we're expecting from the partner. The data is the amount of data. The state is the TCP/IP state. And the IP is the unique packet ID. So I'm going to go into a little bit of detail of what's going on here. The first packet is just a send packet. And when you see the first send packet, that indicates that this side of the connection has initiated a connect request. And the send packet really stands for we're going to synchronize our sequence number. So he's going to send in his initial sequence number. His ACK number is going to be 0 because he has not received any data. The next packet indicates that the remote side acknowledged his send packet and he's sending a synchronous packet so that he can specify his initial sequence number. And his ACK number represents the next byte of data that he's expecting from the remote partner. The third packet represents an acknowledgement that he's received the previous synchronous packet. So after the send, act send, and act, which is called a three-way handshake, after that has occurred, then the connection has been established from a TCP/IP standpoint. But if the application does not accept this connect request, then it will remain in the application's backlog. And if you did a NetStat, con, and you would look at the con ID, if you see a con ID of 00, that it indicates that the three-way handshake has occurred, but the application has not accepted the connect request. Okay, so packet 4 indicates, the 132 bytes indicates that that's the channel has started, and we're sending out the initial data from the sender packet. The next packet indicates that the receiver, the TCP/IP stack on the receiver side, receives this 132 bytes. Okay, the next packet indicates that the receiver is now sending out his initial data, his 132 bytes initial data. The next packet, where the amount of data is 1019, we're sending out the data from the sender channel, and we're acknowledging the 132 bytes that came in previously. Next packet represents the receiver acknowledging the TCP/IP stack on the receiver side, acknowledging the 1019 bytes. And the next packet, the 28 bytes, represents the sender sending out a confirmed packet to the other side, asking him to confirm that he's received the batch of messages and that batch has been placed on the queue. The next package indicates that the receiver received that 28 byte, the next packet indicates that TCP received the 28 bytes of data. And the next packet indicates that the receiver channel is sending back a confirmed reply, which indicates, yes, I got the batch of messages, and I placed that batch of messages on the queue. Okay, so as we continue on, now we're down to packet ID 97EZ2, and we're just in the process of sending data and acknowledging data. Excuse me. And so packet ID EZEZ0DOG, we're sending out our last. Okay, so packet ID EZEZ0DOG, and every packet should have a unique packet ID. So packet ID EZEZ0DOG, we're sending out the last byte of data before we experience the problem. Okay. And so what clued us in on this problem is that we see the AR, the at reset byte, comes back in from the remote partner. And what clued us in on this problem was that the packet ID on the packet, the previous packet and this packet, were the same. And each packet should have a unique packet ID. So that was an indication that we had a problem. Okay, next for you. So we looked at those last two packets in detail, and the key here is that the time to live TTL was 64 when the packet was sent out, and the time to live is just a number that we put on the packets so that the packet does not get into a routing loop in the network. So every time the packet goes out and it hits a destination that's not the final destination, we will subtract one from that number and send the packet on. Next for you. So here is the last packet that came in the reset packet, and the time to live here is 63. So that means that the packet just went one hop, and it came back to us. Now, we knew the customer's topology, and we knew that there was an OSER and a switch and a firewall on the VOS side, and then a router, and then the sound box. So it gave us an indication that one hop away, we were still either at the firewall or the switch. Next for you. So the problem here ended up being we still had to put sniffers before the firewall and after the firewall. Even after looking at this packet trace, we still didn't know exactly where the problem was. So we had to put a sniffer before the firewall and after the firewall, and we were able to figure out that some support person was changing the firewall policies in the middle of the day, and that was causing the broken pipes and the reset. So what I want to drive home here is, even though you see 461 in the Child Initiated Job Log, you see 8 Charlie's Broken Pipes, those are indications that something has occurred in the network, and MQ is just reporting what TCPIP has reported to them. So a lot of times we find that the MQ administrator will report the problem, and they have a difficult time trying to get the network group to work with them to figure out the problem. So we will sometimes look at a sniffer trace, a packet trace, to try to get you close to the situation. But the bottom line, it's up to the customer and their network group to try to figure out what's going on, what's causing the reset, and the broken pipes in these situations. Okay, next for you. Okay, so this is, I have a couple more problems I want to talk about. If you see that your messages are not draining from the transmit queue, messages are backing up on the transmit queue, and you see a CSQX 506 easy message in the Child Initiated Job Log stating that you did not receive your confirmation packet from the remote channel, then it's an indication that you do have a network problem. And the reason that the messages won't drain from the transmit queue is because once we send out the batch of messages and the confirmed request, we won't send any more messages out until we receive that confirmed reply. So again, if you see CSQX 506 easy, there's another indication that there's a network problem. I've only seen one instance where it wasn't a network problem. It was a problem on an AIX box, and there were looping threads. And it wasn't an MQ fix. It was like the operating system fix. So most of the time when you see a CSQX 506 easy, that's another indication of a network problem. Next for you. And this is the last one I want to talk about. When we bring down the channel initiator, sometimes the channel initiator will get hung when we're shutting it down. And I've seen this happen multiple instances. And the reason is when we shut down the channel initiator, we're going to issue a get host by error call to ensure that we're still talking to the correct IP address. And we're going to put that IP address in the message that indicates that the channel is terminated. So if the get host by error call is delayed, then it will delay the shutdown of the channel initiator. And the get host by error can be delayed because of a couple of things that's related to the name server IP address. First of all, if you don't provide the correct name server IP address, the get host by error call won't resolve correctly. If you provide an incorrect name server, it won't be converted correctly. If you provide no IP address, it won't be converted correctly. And if you provide no IP address, then under the cover of TCPIP assumes that you want to use the local file, and most of the time you don't have your local file set up to resolve IP addresses, so the get host by error call can be delayed for that. And also, if you provide a correct IP address for the name server, or you provide a correct host.local file, and the IP address that we are trying to resolve is not in the name server or the local data set, then that can also cause the get host by error call to delay and cause the shutdown of the channel initiator to be delayed. Okay, the next for you, please. Okay, so here's just a list of the documentation that we need to determine network problems. Of course, the display channel status to figure out the status of the channel. We're going to need some MQ internal traces. We're going to need the dump of the master in the CHIN, and especially the CHIN, because there are 21 entries that we write out for each channel in the channel initiator, so we can see the last 21 things that occurred for that channel if we get a dump of the channel initiator. We're also going to need packet trace, sniffer traces to see what's flowing on the network. We're going to need the channel initiator job log and the master job log just to see what time the errors occurred, IP addresses involved. And if your remote partner is a distributed platform, we're going to need the FDCs and the error logs from the remote partner. It looks like a lot of documentation, but if we want to see a complete picture of what happened, then it's, you know, best to get this amount of documentation, and we should only need to get it one time if we capture it in this first set of dots. Okay, next for you. Okay, this is just to reiterate what you need to do to send documentation to the Level 2 support. And I want to point out that you need to ensure that you use the data set naming convention that's mentioned here so that your problem record is updated automatically when you put documentation on the server. And a lot of confusion over the country code for USA. The country code for USA is 000. So if you adhere to this data set naming convention, we will see your documentation and can process it much quicker. Next for you. Okay, and this is just a list of noteworthy APARs, and you can read at your leisure. Next for you. And these are some of the websites, the MQ homepage, and you can do search criteria from here, such as tech notes, must-gather documentation, APARs. You can put APARs in the search criteria, and you can find these APARs online. This is a link for the MQ series primer, and the primer is a good book, you know, to give to somebody who's trying to get familiar with MQ. It gives an overall view of MQ. Next for you. This is an example of the information center, and this contains the manual, so you can search keywords, parameters, just to determine what manual you'll find these keywords and parameters. So the Information Center is very good for searching and helping you find information very quickly. Next for you. Okay. So this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for the WebSphere product. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. The event link on support pages points you to webcast and conference information. Visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistance consists of self-help modules to get new users up to the learning curve quickly. The ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Support link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates of products of interest to you. That's it for me. Now I'm going to turn it back over to the moderator.
All right. Thank you, Kenneth and Lorna, for a great presentation. At this point, Tom, we would like to open the lines for questions. I will now turn the call over to Kenneth Langhorne and Lorna Wheeler.
And we do have a question from John Oatman.
Yes, good morning. I have one question regarding the TCPIP reason or return codes, however they're noted in here. In which library center bookshelf are those documented?
In the MQ series messages and codes, we list the primary TCPIP codes. The ones that we covered today should be in the back of our book, but they would probably also be in the TCPIP manual.
And the Unix System Service Manual.
Okay, that's really where I was going after.
Okay.
That's where I thought that were at, but I just wanted to confirm that. Thank you.
Looks like we have a question from Owen Kaczynski.
Yes. Do you have a URL for picking up a copy of this presentation today? I missed part of it.
Sure, I can answer that. So if you actually go to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site, you can view the presentation. Otherwise, you can go to any IBM.com site and type the tech doc number 7008616 in the search box found at the very top right of the page, and that will take you to the PDF file.
Thank you.
Ms. Snyder, there appears to be no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. And at this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation as well. Remember, a replay of this presentation will be available on the WebSphere Technical Exchange site early next week. We hope you will join us for further presentations, which will also be announced on this site. Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you, Kenneth and Laurinette, for presenting.
You're welcome.
This does conclude today's conference call. We appreciate your participation. You may disconnect at this time.